sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Alice Langholt, author of the new novel on Adam and Eve called First Family. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim Barel Kachar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's midsummer now, which also means it'll be Bastille Day this coming week, July 14th, the National Independence Day for France. And wouldn't it be nice to be vacationing in France right about now? Close your eyes, unless you're driving, of course, and think, if you would, for a moment about France. The Arc de Triomphe, the bridges over the Seine, the Eiffel Tower, Notre Dame, wine, cheese, croissant with jam and coffee, great food, great art, beautiful countryside, bicycle riders, a musical language, the tricolor flag, beautiful cities filled with cathedrals, and very rude people. You know, France, far from the heat of a Western summer. Just in time for Bastille Day this week. So you ask, Rabbi, what possible Jewish meaning can this whole soliloquy have? Aha, I say. You may not know this, but the first nation in the Old World that guaranteed full citizenship to Jews was Revolutionary France. Without the French Revolution of 1789, Jewish history in Europe and the world would have been very different. We are grateful to our own country of America, whose 4th of July we celebrated last week here on Two Jewish, but we should retain some respect for the country that created the first Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and which benefited our people, the Jews in particular. My favorite weird historical question that most people don't get is this: who was it that broke down the walls of the ghettos of Europe, walls that had existed since the early 1500s? Who emancipated the Jews of Western Europe? The answer is Napoleon Bonaparte. You see, when Napoleon was conquering Europe in the 1790s and early 1800s, his armies were fighting, at least in theory, for liberty, equality, and fraternity. He had no love for religion, and certainly not for the old order of the church that had enforced so many terrible rules and constraints on Jews throughout the Middle Ages and Renaissance, well into early modern times. And while Napoleon had no particular regard one way or the other for Jews, he was a non-com from the island of Corsica after all, he had little exposure to Jews, Napoleon nonetheless had a very strong sense of the necessity to break down the old bad order, the Ancien Régime. As he said, "To the Jews as a commune," meaning a people, "nothing. To the Jew as an individual citizen of France, all rights and privileges," which was a very great change and a gift, a great gift at that time in the world. And so, as the French armies crossed Europe, conquering, plundering, establishing their own governments everywhere, they also, almost as an afterthought, broke down the walls of every single ghetto they encountered and let the Jews out. And they established, for at least a period of time, a new legal system, the Code Napoleon, which allowed Jews to go to university for the first time, to serve in the military, to be part of the civil service, to live where they wanted, to live as full citizens, at least officially. It was an extraordinarily important moment in Jewish history. France enabled us to enter the modern world, at least wherever its armies had control, and the ghetto walls were never reestablished in quite the same way, or with quite the same force, not least until Hitler came along. That meant that we Jews suddenly could experience everything Europe and the modern world of the time had to offer. It made possible the extraordinary success and accomplishments and experiences of modernity for Jews. It was actually while Napoleon controlled Germany that Reform Judaism was born, an Enlightenment form of Jewish belief and practice that catalyzed all modern Judaism, either inspiring it or in reaction against it. In the long run, it made possible Zionism and the State of Israel. It was earth-shaking, and it was all because of France. Nowadays, you're likely to hear a great deal of anti-French rhetoric in Jewish circles. There is anti-Semitism. The Muslim immigrants perpetrate acts against Jews. They support the Arabs. They do anti-Semitic actions and violence and so on. Many French Jews have even purchased apartments in Israel as a protection against the rise of Muslim anti-Semitism in France. Go to Netanya, you'll see many of them. But in truth, Jewry in France is a much more nuanced picture than just us being attacked today. France retains the largest Jewish community in all of Europe. Paris has the largest Jewish population of any city in Europe, and it retains a vital and active communal life. A recent past president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, had Jewish ancestors and did a tremendous job countering anti-Semitism and improving Holocaust education, as well as building the French relationship with Israel. The presidents that have followed, at least so far, have continued that work. We retain hope that Jewish life in France, which has flourished since Roman times, will continue vibrant and vital. Bastille Day also provides us with a wonderful excuse to play a comedy cut from one of our all-time favorite Jewish comedians, the late and very great Alan Sherman. Here's a special tribute to France and Bastille Day itself when the French overthrew the tyranny of King Louis XVI and entered the modern world. It's called You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis.
Louis XVI was the King of France in 1789. He was worse than Louis XV. He was worse than Louis XIV. He was worse than Louis XIII. He was the worst since Louis I. King Louis was living like a king, but the people were living rotten. So the people, they started an uprising, which they called the French Revolution. And of course, you remember their battle cry, which will never be forgotten. Went the wrong way, old King Louis. You made the population cry, 'cause all you did was sit and pet with Marie Antoinette in your place at Versailles. And now the country's gone kablooey, so we are giving you the air that ought to teach you not to spend all your time fooling round at the Folies Bergères. If you had been a nicer king, we wouldn't do a thing. But you were bad, you must admit. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine and shorten you a little bit. You came the wrong way, old King Louis, and now you ain't got far to go. Too bad you won't be here to see that great big Eiffel Tower or Brigitte Bardot. To you, King Louis, we say fooey. You disappointed all of France. But then what else could we expect from a king in silk stockings and pink satin pants? You filled your stomach with chop suey and also crepe Suzette's and steak. And when they told your wife Marie that nobody had bread, she said, let them eat cake. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine. It's somewhere in the heart of town. And when that fella there is through with what he's gonna do, you'll have no place to wear your crown. You came the wrong way, old King Louis. Now we must put you on the shelf. That's why the people are revolting, 'cause Louis, you're pretty revolting yourself.
Never let it be said that Too Jewish doesn't provide the finest and sophisticated Jewish cultures at all times and seasons. That was Alan Sherman's You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louie, a fitting capstone to our Bastille Day commemoration and a mini history of French Jewry. Actually, a little more coming a little bit later in the show. Our guest this morning, Alice Langholt, has written a beautiful new novel about Adam and Eve called First Family. Find out what makes it unique when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Alice Langholt is the author of a new book, First Family, about, well, the first family of humanity, Adam and Eve. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. So I have to ask you a funny question. Your previous career, it still is in Reiki work, healing and awakening work. How does that translate to writing?
Well, I do a lot of writing about self-care and about energy healing, and I'm currently in a PhD program in metaphysical science. So I think writing is just a part of me, and I can express whatever I'm thinking about, whatever I want to share through the medium of writing. Before I was into Reiki, I was a Jewish educator, and I do have a master's degree in Jewish studies. And creative writing has always been something that I've enjoyed. I used to write and direct Jewish musicals. When I worked as a Jewish educator, that was something that I did two a year. And if I'm not being creative, I'm really miserable. So
I should also note that you are the creator of the Apples to Apples Jewish Edition game, which my family enjoyed very much when my kids were younger. So a little bit of personal revelation there. Your book is about Adam and Eve. You did bibliodrama for a long time, for a couple years. Did that contribute to sort of developing the idea that you wanted to write about the first family?
Yeah, it did. Exactly. In fact, that training is what I got my master's degree in for my Jewish studies master's degree, because I did my thesis about how to use bibliodrama to teach Torah in the classroom. And so it's a really cool process and really creative and fun and interesting, thought-provoking and all of that. And so I guess I was really bored one day, and I was teaching a Parsha Shavua class, and so I needed to do some, biblical discussion with my bored seventh graders, and I wanted to find a new way to talk about the text. And so I started playing around with the Bereishit story, and I started doing some creative writing using the bibliodrama technique with myself. And I started as a blog, and this was a long time ago. I mean, this was back when blogs were kind of a new thing.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was a long time ago. I would just put a new entry in every couple of days. It became a creative writing exercise for myself as I studied the text. And it was just fun and fascinating, and people started reading it. And I would get like 300 comments and things like that, and it became kind of interesting until the blog platform decided they were going to shut down. I had heard that they were going to close, so I copied all of my posts and saved them in a document, and I continued by myself until it became the book, but it wasn't the book yet. It was good, but it wasn't good enough. And I basically shelved it for about 10 years.
Well, we will come back and explore more about how First Family evolved over those 10 years and when you came back to it with Alice Langholt. And we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Well, we began this pre-Bastille Day show with lots of positive associations about the historical relationship of France and the Jews, but the reality today is much more complex and somewhat darker. Sadly, you don't need to go back to the days of the Holocaust and the collaboration of many in the French government in rounding up Jews, turning them over to the Nazis, to find ugly reminders of anti-Semitism. Today's France is a complicated place. There are many residents of former French colonies in North Africa who have made their home in Marseille and in the poor neighborhood developments outside of Paris and elsewhere around the country. And while officially the French government's policy against anti-Semitic hate crimes is stringent indeed, there has been a concern that often the authorities pretend that obviously anti-Semitic Muslim violence against Jews is not motivated by religion. There was one horrifying incident in particular that shocked and angered the French Jewish community just this past spring. In April, a 65-year-old physician who ran a kindergarten named Sarah Halimi was brutally beaten and hurled to her death from the third-floor window of her Paris apartment. The murderer was a man named Kobili Traor, who shouted Allahu Akbar before throwing her from the window to her death. French prosecutors initially listed the crime as voluntary manslaughter and made no mention of the facts that demonstrated it was a hate crime and anti-Semitic in nature. That omission, along with the indifference of authorities and the media in France to a crime that was largely eclipsed by a dramatic election campaign for president, left many members and leaders of the country's traumatized Jewish community feeling marginalized and angry at a French society that's reluctant to confront its anti-Semitism today head on. Everything about this crime suggests there's an ongoing denial of reality by authorities, said 17 French intellectuals in an open letter published in Le Figaro in June. We demand all the truth be brought to light in the murder of Sarah Halimi, they added. The authors included Elaine Finkelstein, a Jewish philosopher and a member of the Académie Française, the guardian of French language and culture. Repeatedly, the anti-Semitic and Islamist elements in outrages in France have been downplayed by French authorities, at least at first, and by the media, until the details are eventually publicized by Jewish groups and they have to respond. It's notable and depressing that the rise of right-wing anti-Semitism in France has also been largely ignored by the authorities. France was indeed the first country to emancipate Jews, to give us full human rights. As we approach the 228th birthday of the modern nation of liberty, equality, and fraternity, may we see her return to live out the idealism of her inspirational beginnings. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So we tend to think of Yiddish as a German mix of a mix of German and Hebrew that came out of Central Europe, but there's another possibility, apparently.
Right. I just read a really interesting article that somebody forwarded to me online from a website called theconversation.com. I don't know if this article was actually published, but it's called Uncovering Ancient Ashkenaz, the Birthplace of Yiddish Speakers. And the article says that for at least 1,000 years, people have been trying to figure out where Ashkenaz is, because it's thought to be the birthplace of both Ashkenazic Jewry and the Yiddish language. We know where Sfarad is. I mean, it's Spain, or more broadly, the Iberian Peninsula,
right.
And that's the origin of true Sephardic Jewry, although not the origin of all the Edot HaMizrach, so-called Oriental Jews, who many people confuse with Sephardim, because they're not Ashkenazic. So what this article says is that in the Tanakh, the term Ashkenaz is mentioned three times, but by the Middle Ages, no Jewish scholars knew with any certainty where Ashkenaz was. It had been forgotten. But obviously, if the term is in the Tanakh, it probably isn't Germany. It's probably somewhere in the Middle East that the collective group of people who wrote and compiled the Tanakh were familiar with. So they did one of these genome searches and also linguistic root searches, and they found four villages in northeastern Turkey, which all have names suspiciously close to Ashkenaz, like Ashkenaz, Ashkenuz, whatever, Ashkenaz. And they found that that was the epicenter of this gene type, genetic code. And they theorize in this article that traders along the Silk Route, where another Silk Route is east-west, obviously, between China and Byzantium, and there's a north-south trade route from the Persian Gulf up to Crimea and on to Europe that crosses very near these four villages. And so the theory is that Jewish traders in this region at the crossroads of these two great trading routes wanted to develop a secret language to do business in. And the original earliest traces of Yiddish have like 140 words for buying and selling, lending support to this, lending some credence to this. And then the article goes on to explain that there were both Germanic and Slavic accretions because these merchants very soon after the 7th and 8th century moved to Khazaria, and then one branch moved north into Slavic territories like Russia, Ukraine, et cetera, and one moved northwest into Germanic
Austria,
Central
Germany,
Europe, Austro-Hungary, right, Germany, et cetera. So right, that also helps to explain why there are two vastly different dialects of Yiddish today, like Litvak and Galicianer. The Galicianers were Austro-Hungarians, and the Litvaks were living in the Tsarist space, a Slavic speaking, although Lithuania doesn't speak a Slavic language.
Right. Just to make it more complicated.
Right.
You know, there's so many, this opens up so many things. I think of the Raidenite travelers in the Middle Ages and some of the interesting ways in which Jewish culture was sort of cross-pollinated all across the world. There weren't so many Jews, but really in diverse places. And Yiddish comes from Turkey, apparently.
Who knew, right?
Who knew? Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi non-Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Abay.
We started speaking last week about something called Mechina, which is a preparatory year that high school graduates from Israel experience before they go in the army. The standard is you're 18, you take the Bagrut or whatever it is, you pass your exams, and you go into the army, you know, pretty shortly thereafter. Now there's this extra preparatory year in which people explore themselves, explore their country, and get themselves ready. How does it work? Like, how do you do it?
Okay, so it's really, it's a physical place. It's like you go to college, but it's not college. Usually it's a small, you know, in the periphery, mainly in the periphery of Israel, and also
meaning
in some
not
of,
Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, or Haifa.
Also, but the majority will be spread all over Israel and again in the periphery. There is one next to my hometown, Beit Shean.
Beit Shean, right,
yeah,
of course.
So, and they are bringing together, and the goal is, like, first of all, bring together Israelis from, you know, diversity, background. You know, you will find like some of them will be Kippah Seruga, who is a very Chiloni.
That's modern Orthodox.
Yes. And with a very, very secular Israelis.
Right.
And, you know, they allow themselves, they allow you dialogue to, you know, because usually until 18, you are, you know, you're in your family, your community, you know.
Your school, and if your school is a Chiloni,
kind of
a secular school,
okay,
you're
kind
that
of in a bubble. And then from this bubble, you're supposed to go to the army and you find everyone else. And sometimes you don't have the tools as an 18 years old to deal with this together with a combat, you know, soldier. There's too much to digest at once.
Right.
And I think that's why they came with the program. And first of all, when you allow this kind of dialogue, you make this person as a person a better one because he's open to see the world in different lens and not just the lens he had for 18 years. That's very important, this component of the program. But, and they live together and they are volunteering in the community that surround them. So here you have a social action component and definitely Jewish text, and not just Jewish text, like learning about the history of Israel, because it connects you better to your country. You understand why you are going to fight for this country. What is your roots? And it's definitely important. And did I mention the physical training?
Not exactly.
Yeah, but it's my... We're Jews at the end of the day. How much physical training you can include in a program? Anyway, sorry. Did I say it out loud?
I'm sure there's some physical training involved nonetheless.
Yes, but it's a lot here. Like
intellectual,
if you,
mental
Oh, sorry. So if you really train the person to believe in what he's doing, finding like why he's doing it, believe
right.
in it,
right.
and then he will give his best. And then the physical training, usually it's outside workshop. It's not doing in the physical place. But yes, there is also this. And definitely the results are speaking for themselves. It's a beautiful result. And did I mention that there is 54 mechinot all over the country?
I don't know if you did, but it's very interesting and it's a growing program.
And some of them are really religious, like Eli. The first one is in Eli.
Yeah.
And there is even a law that was approved in the Knesset of Israel with the majority of 70 people. 70 members of the Knesset. You don't see them a lot. But
no,
that's showing like how they see the impact and the
how
importance of it.
How positive they feel the impact has been. Very interesting and useful and kind of like a pre-army training year. And of course, it makes your service longer, right? It adds an extra year, but it changes the whole experience. Thanks so much, Ashrat. We'll talk
Toda next Rabbi.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Or, good morning.
Good morning. You know, you have a unique task in a Jewish day school environment. You have to teach Hebrew.
Yes.
Now, in a synagogue school, we teach reading, writing, the chanting of prayers, chanting of Torah, but you also have to teach Hebrew as a modern language with mm-hmm. vocabulary, grammar,
yeah.
the ability to do stuff, and you also have to teach all the regular subjects, reading, writing, arithmetic,
right.
history, English, all that stuff. How do you balance that? What's the best way to approach that?
Sure. Well, first of all, you got to be organized. So one of our tricks is we actually have a little bit of a longer school day than a typical school day you might find in the public system. So we add on a little more time and we make it work. We have a carefully structured and established school day with a tight schedule, and teachers adapt the pacing of the curriculum to that schedule, and students certainly learn how to go through those days very, very easily and quickly. So teaching is a complicated teaching Hebrew is a complicated subject. You yourself just referenced the three different types of Hebrew that there are. So not only is there the Torah, ancient text type of Hebrew language, there's also the Hebrew of prayer book, and then there's the modern Hebrew language. And so when we teach Hebrew, quote unquote, we're really teaching modern Hebrew. And it's about listening, reading, writing, and speaking the language. We take a structured approach every day of the week from kindergarten through eighth grade. And there we have, you know, adopted curriculum. So we have materials and supplies that we use as instructional tools. In our older grades, we started a program last year called Netta, and it really emphasizes dialogue and conversation as well as reading comprehension. You know, kids are taught in the younger years, the alphabet, the shape of the letters, the sound of the letters, the one-to-one correspondence of what a letter looks like and sounds like, and how you write it and read it, and building on vocabulary, putting those letters together into words, and then forming sentences and building and building and building, much like you do with learning to read in the young years.
Do you find that there are sometimes challenges with kids who are learning both languages at the same time?
It's tough. And we have kids who come in who have a trilingual environment. You know, they might be hearing at home
Spanish
or Russian.
Right.
And so, you know, every learner takes their time to emerge as a learner. And so we're able to take that into account. We're able to level the groups so that those who are ready for more advanced challenges and application have that opportunity. Those who are learning the basics have that opportunity. And we have kids coming in all the time who know no Hebrew at any age, and we're able to kind of take them where they are and move them forward. So you build a program that meets the needs of each learner, and you work at it, and you work at it, and you work at it, and you celebrate it too. Lots of opportunities to celebrate accomplishments and the language itself.
It's a great opportunity, and it creates really such a diverse educational background. I think it's really helpful in the long run.
It's so important for us as a people, because part of who we are is the language that we speak, and knowing that really opens up very important avenues and experiences as a Jew.
Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Have a great week.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two bees meet, and one says to the other, "How are things with you?" "Really bad," says a second bee. "The weather's too dang hot. There aren't any flowers. They're all burned up. I can't make honey." "No problem," said the first bee. "Just fly 5 blocks down and turn left. Keep going until you see the cars. There's a bar mitzvah going on, and there are all kinds of fresh flowers in that party." "Thanks for the tip," says the second bee and flies away. An hour later, the two bees run into each other again. The first bee says, "How's it going?" "Great," says the second bee. "It was everything you said it would be. There's a huge floral arrangement on each table at the bar mitzvah. I got lots and lots of pollen." "Great, great," says the first bee. "But what's that on your head?" "Oh, that's my yarmulke," says the second bee. "I didn't want them to think I was a wasp." You see, a wasp is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature, Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Be well? And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion from the latter part of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. It's named after a man called Pinchas, whose story really began at the end of last week's portion of Balak. The situation's familiar. For the umpteenth time, the people of Israel have been disobeying the Torah and worshiping other gods. This time, the apostasy has reached epidemic proportion. Even the elite leadership of the people has begun to sample the religious wares of the Midianites and Moabites. Finally, one of the princes of the people challenges the authority of Moses publicly by taking a sacred prostitute into his tent while the whole assembly of Israel watches. As Moses and the other elders stand by shocked, unable to respond to such a chutzpahdik act, a young Kohen, a priest named Pinchas, steps forward. He kills the wayward prince and his consort and breaks the spell of the false religious practice. For this act, he is rewarded by God, which seems to validate his violent vigilantism. But there is more to the story than meets the eye. For Pinchas' reward for killing the couple is a brit shalom, a covenant of peace. Neither he nor any of his descendants is ever again permitted to go to war or to carry a spear. He must instead minister to the needs of the tabernacle, the rituals of the altar, of purification and sacrifice. He can never engage in any more acts of violence. Pinchas has broken the Israelites' latest fascination with paganism, but never again will that level of religious violence be tolerated among Jews. It must instead be sublimated to serve the needs of the community, an ongoing lesson about the dangers of religious fanaticism. For Judaism refuses to countenance the kind of religious insanity that led to the Crusades, or to Jihad, or to ISIS, or the Inquisition, or any kind of religious terrorism. In spite of the occasional anomaly, Jewish religious fervor is never designed to lead to violence. We are committed, fervently and firmly, to the same Brit Shalom, the covenant of peace that God places on Pinchas. So must it always be. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, author Alice Langholt, will help us see Adam and Eve and the first family in a totally new way. Find out how when we come back in a moment, right here on To Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students, a rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Batsheva Appel.
Three AIPAC leaders, outgoing President Lillian Pincus, her successor, Mort Friedman, and Vice CEO Richard Fishman, flew to Israel for an emergency meeting and reportedly warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of a crisis of faith among American Jews in the aftermath of the freezing of the Western Wall Agreement. They offered what a source familiar with what happened at the meeting told JTA was an analysis of the impact of the freeze on American Jews and the divisions it might cause. The Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, which represents more than 50 national Jewish groups, in a letter to Netanyahu, said that a lack of unity between diaspora Jews and Israel over the Western Wall Agreement could lead to an erosion of support. Four Jewish members of Congress criticized Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's suspension of an agreement to build a non-Orthodox prayer space at the Western Wall. Representatives Elliot Engel, Nita Lowy, and Jerry Nadler of New York joined Representative Ted Deutsch of Florida in criticizing Netanyahu for reneging on the deal in a Sunday cabinet vote. The lawmakers are all Democrats. Netanyahu said his cabinet had suspended the deal passed in 2016 as a result of negotiations between the Reform and Conservative movements, the Women of the Wall, the Jewish Agency for Israel, and the Israeli government. The suspension came after Netanyahu's Haredi Orthodox coalition partners put pressure on Netanyahu to scrap the agreement, which would have expanded the egalitarian prayer section. Netanyahu's suspension raised ire among an array of critics, including the Jewish Agency for Israel and the Reform Movement, which both canceled meetings with the prime minister in the wake of the decision. Israeli diplomats in North America rejected a talking point handed down to them from Jerusalem, which they told an Israeli daily blames liberal Jews for the Western Wall controversy. The top diplomats refused to repeat the narrative that Jonathan Schechter, a top advisor to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, handed down to them in telephone conversations about the crisis in relations between the government and the leaders of the Reform and other liberal Jewish denominations in the United States, Ma'ariv reported. Netanyahu's office unequivocally denied the report in a statement to JTA. Hundreds in Jerusalem protested the freeze on the Western Wall deal and the conversion bill. The demonstrators carried signs with slogans like Judaism without coercion and We are all women of the wall. The same day as the announcement of the freeze of the plans for the Western Wall, a ministerial committee approved a bill that would have made the Haredi Orthodox-dominated chief rabbinate the only body authorized by the government to perform conversions in Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office announced the legislation will not be considered for 6 months while a team he will appoint comes up with recommendations for an arrangement on the issue. A teenager has been arrested and charged with vandalizing a Jewish camp in upstate New York. Camp Shomria in Liberty, New York, run by the Hashomer Hatzair movement, was broken into on June 12th. The interior and exterior of several of the buildings was damaged and covered in anti-Semitic graffiti. Christopher Santoro, 18, was arraigned on Wednesday in the town of Fallsburg Justice Court on felony charges of third-degree burglary and fourth-degree criminal mischief as a hate crime. The 100-year-old camp bills itself as the kibbutz in the Catskills. And this is Rabbi Batsheva Pell with the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Alice Langholt, is the author of a new book, First Family, about Adam and Eve, a very creative and kind of different approach to the first family of humanity. She's a Jewish educator, a Reiki, I don't know, instructor, teacher, expert, and a very interesting and dynamic person. You mentioned when we spoke earlier about the fact that you had this as a blog and then you put it aside for about 10 years. How did it come back?
It came back when my daughter, I have four children, and that sort of happened in the meantime of my blog being...
Oh, yeah, just along the way, you know.
Exactly. So my number two, my daughter, Sari, is a really, really good writer. And I was telling her about this because it's always been close to my heart. I've always really enjoyed the process of writing. I discovered so much thinking about parenting, thinking about grief. I mean, if you're going to explore the characters of the Adam and Eve story in a first-person way, you have to think about the emotions and the step-by-step things that would have happened with children growing up and why all of these things happened and getting into the minds of any of these characters. So it was a very personal experience to write this. And so I was talking about it with Sari, and she said, well, let me read it. And I'm like, well, I just don't think it's, you know, very, it's not ready to publish. She's like, let me read it, Mom. I'm like, okay. So I let her read it. And she came back to me. She goes, this is really good, but it has too much tell and not enough show. And I said, I know that's a literary thing, but I'm not really sure what that means. And she goes, Mom, I can help you. Let me work on it with you. And I said, okay. So we spent 4 days together over the summer, totally immersed in sensory experiences and translating them into descriptive words, meaning like we laid outside on the grass and described what that was like without using words like I'm laying in the grass. But what did it feel like to do that? What did it feel like to discover that you have a face, you know? And we made that, you know, part of Adam's awakening, discovering his face without knowing what a face is and what does that feel like. So describing the tactile, sensory words, and that and all these different places in the book where we stopped and did things to try to really understand what does this feel like and describe it rather than just talking about it. And that 4 days that we spent together, like full time, was really wonderful for the two of us and extremely wonderful for the book. It made the book so rich and so real and so vibrant that when we were done and I had gone through a few more editing passes on my own, I knew it was ready. And I published it.
There are a variety of different approaches to the story of Adam and Eve. You can make a case that there's two different approaches in Genesis itself. Was it all sort of emotive? How did you make the choices that you made?
Well, I chose the one that had a little bit more story. Okay. And so that's the one where Adam is alone and you know, names the animals, but feels like he's the only one and kind of asks God, you know, or expresses his loneliness to God, and God creates Eve from his rib, you know, or so, you know, the story goes. And I was very careful when I was doing the reading that not to add, not to contradict the text. So I chose that story because it had a little bit more information, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't writing anything in there that contradicted what was in the text, but the text is very sparse and leaves an incredible amount to the imagination. which made it really fun, actually.
What was the most surprising thing you experienced in writing First Family? What did you come up with that you didn't expect?
Yeah, so one thing that I had to ask myself was, why did they make an offering to God? It does not use the word sacrifice, so they weren't killing anything. But why did they decide to make an offering to God? Where did that idea come from? And what was the purpose? And how were the kids, how did the kids, the boys, get involved in this? You know, there had to be a lot of planning. There had to be a lot of discussion. And I needed to explore the question about what was it they wanted in, you know, in deciding to do this. And that, I decided, for the purposes of this book, was that Adam was the one who had initiated it, because he wanted to establish a relationship with God. After being kicked out of the garden, after they left, they really didn't have any more dialogue with God in the text. And I thought it would make sense for Adam to still be wanting a relationship, to hear from God, versus, you know, perhaps Eve maybe not being that interested in comparison. So I thought, if this is Adam's idea and Adam wants a relationship with God, which of the children, you know, are going to be, you know, engaged in that the most with him? And it made a lot of sense that it would be Abel, especially based on what happened, but that he did get Cain to do it also. So I had to explore Cain's feelings about all of this, and Abel and Cain having never met God. Like, there was so much to explore in terms of, like, this, who is God and how can I have a relationship with God? So that was a very big part of the story. And I think it's an underlying theme for Eve. And you know what else I discovered, which was amazing, Rabbi, is that as I was exploring all of these characters, I realized that I am all of these characters. My own spiritual path and search is woven in here in such a way that I just really could see myself, and especially Eve, of course. I had a lot of skepticism, or basically need for confirmation, which is where Reiki kind of came into my life and made a difference for me, because Reiki is an energy healing method where I can feel energy and I can help somebody and they can feel it. And it's very fulfilling to know that there's something bigger than my own physical self that I can use to help somebody. And it is a part of, like, the Echad. And that's a whole other discussion. But all of that, you know?
Sure. There is such a sense of discovery in the book, particularly in the opening stages, in which both Adam and Eve, I guess they're not named yet, are kind of trying things and finding things, which is, I think, a part of the story that textually in the Tanakh, and then really even in Midrash, gets skipped right over. You just kind of go into the moral issues or the developmental issues. You spent a lot of time in that development. Was that a choice, or did it just seem like a natural course?
I think it was necessary, because in order for someone to feel connected with one of these characters, they have to say, well, what was it like to wake up? I mean, that's a question I had to answer right from the beginning. What was it like to suddenly wake up and be alive and be aware, and everything is new and a little scary and so much sensory input? I mean, if I had skipped that or not gone into detail, I wouldn't have done justice to the character development at all, or the story. And it's not, and I think it's equally as important. This whole coming into awareness is a part of life, and as parents, as people, as children, like, it's, everything is a new experience when we first experience it. So I felt like it was incredibly important. And then, of course, later, as they, you know, become parents, and then, you know, there's so many questions, like, how did they, you know, discover the body of Abel? What did they think happened? Cain was gone. Where did they think he was? And they had to try to piece together, and then what should they do with this body? Where, what did they think was going to happen? You know, would he wake up? What could be done? And all of these feelings, and all of them, then what, you know, the next year, then what happened between then and Eve being pregnant with Seth? I mean, there's so much relationship.
You know, it's funny. I don't know why this occurred to me, but I was thinking of that song from Company by Stephen Sondheim, Being Alive. You know, it's about that intensity and experiencing that, which is a very different way to approach it than most people approach the text. It works, I think, very well, and it makes it fresh and different. There have been other efforts to create, of course, novels based on biblical stories. Anita Diamond's The Red Tent comes to mind, lots of others. Some of them fall into traps. You try not to do that. Was that conscious also?
Very. That was extremely deliberate. And I'll tell you why. I really have a very deep respect for the text. I mean, as, you know, as a Jewish educator and as a Jew, I really, you know, grew up, you know, with a reverence for Torah in terms of what can it teach us and what can we learn from it, especially, you know, what is the point of this being a sacred text and that exploration. I was very much against going, you know, contradicting the text in any way, because I feel that makes Midrash authentic if it's true to the text. And that's one of the problems I have with The Red Tent, is that she does cross that line. Diamant crosses that line and even says, well, the text, you know, the story says this, but that's not true. It goes like this. I mean, one of her characters says that. This is what really happened. I was not going to do that. I wanted this to be something that could have happened. It could have happened this way. Now, I don't believe that this is that it factually, you know, this story is true exactly. You know, I don't, but that's not the point of this. The point is to explore the humanity in the story, personalize it, and learn from it. You know, a story of growth and hope and faith and grief and, you know, being alive.
What was the most fulfilling part about creating this?
Well, besides working with Sari.
Yeah, that's kind of fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And in fact, I shouldn't even say besides, because maybe that is what was the most fulfilling. I would say that was the number one, maybe I have two. But the number one thing was working with my daughter and exploring this together as a living connection to a textual story, you know, and so infusing, like, there's a Jewish connection that happens when you study it enough to make it personal. And for us to do that together and explore writing together. And then when the book, it did win finalist in the Reader's Favorite International Book Awards for inspirational fiction, I took Sari with me, of course, to the awards ceremony. And doing that together as, like, you know, co-writers, basically, was a really nice bonding experience for the two of us also. So connection to Judaism, connection to each other, and the process of respecting her as a writer and giving her that kind of a boost because she really deserves it was also a good thing. So I guess that's my number one.
Where can people find out more about it? Where can they get it?
Well, the easiest place, of course, is Amazon. It's really the easiest.
It is, for sure.
Barnes and Noble and all.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. No, no, I know, of course.
But you know what else, though? I did also publish it for Audible. So I found a voice narrator, and he's a guy. And he did the audio book version of it, and I think he did a splendid job. So the Audible version is really kind of cool for those who like audio books.
And people can also go to your website, which is alicelangholt.com.
Yeah, that's my author website. And there you can also find some videos, and which are also on YouTube, of Sari reading some sections of the book and me reading some sections of the book also, if you want to get a sense of what it sounds like.
Alice, thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish, and best of luck with First Family.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. By the way, anyone that visits my website, they can have a digital copy free if they want to leave a review on Amazon, and they can request that through my website.
No, that's a deal. Thanks so much. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Shai Held, the President, Dean, and Chair in Jewish Thought at Machon Hadar, author of a new book of essays on the Torah called The Heart of Torah. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from the Maccabees. It's their a cappella version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, set to the words for Lachadodi, the song of welcome for Shabbat. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.